So, let me start. Well, the Casimir effect is often illustrated by one of these two pictures. You can find, for example, on the wiki space of this program now a similar picture to this one, and the other one I took from one of Stephen Hawking's books. Now, the picture on the left gives you a quite precise description of the steps Casimir performed in his original paper to compute the Casimir force between two parallel plates. You have to find the modes of the fluctuating field and afterwards sum over the modes to obtain the Casimir energy. Now, for geometries more complicated than the parallel plates, this is can be very difficult, or often it's even impossible to perform this step on the spectrum, the sum. Now, by contrast, the world line approach, which is more related to the picture on the right, works for any geometry of the boundaries. Now, what we do is, in the manner of some previous work, we formulate the Casimir problem in terms of a renormalizable field theory, and we restrict our studies to a scalar quantum field. And this quantum field is coupled to a classic background potential. Now we can choose a background potential which is has delta functional-like shape where the boundaries are. So the quantum fluctuations of the scalar field are completely suppressed on the boundaries, and we obtain Dirichlet boundary conditions. Now, the ground state energy, or Casimir energy if you want, is closely related to the Euclidean effective action. In this context, we study the effective action as functional of the classic potential, and therewith as a function of parameters describing this classic potential, distances, for example, or angles. So by derivatives, you can obtain Casimir forces, or Casimir torques, and so on. So we want to compute the effective action. And this can be done by a loop expansion. In this case, there's only this one loop term containing all one loop diagrams to any order of perturbation theory. Now, after performing the functional derivatives, we need to trace over the log of this fluctuation operator. And here we introduce an integral representation for the log and perform the trace in X space. And now you can see we end up with a term which resembles a transition amplitude in non-relativistic quantum mechanics and can now be written as Feynman path integral. So we integrate over closed paths from x to x in d-dimensional Euclidean space-time, so over closed world lines. Now this world line formalism has a long history and goes back to Feynman in 1950. The normalization constant of the path integral can be obtained by looking at the zero potential limit, where we can compute the amplitude analytically, and it yields an additional t-dependent term. And now, using this world line expectation notation, we can write down the ground state energy in this very compact form. Now note that until now, this integration variable is the common point of the loop, the common starting and end point of the loops we use to compute this expectation value. However, by shifting the loops, we can also use loops with closed world lines with common center of mass to compute this expectation value, and afterwards integrate over all center of masses. And this is actually what we've done for all the results I show you later. We want to compute Casimir forces. Casimir forces between separate objects. So we can subtract the self-energy of the single objects And for us, this means we need to compute the expectation value of this quantity here, which I've also shifted by 1 to obtain 0 and the 0 field limit. Now we put in our delta functional potential. So this is supposed to be delta functional on the surfaces denoted by sigma. And if we put this in, it turns out that this expression evaluates to 1 if and only if the given world line intersects both objects, and it's 0 otherwise. So we denote this by a theta functional. And using this notation, we end up with this very simple formula for the Casimir interaction energy in the world line picture. This has been derived in 2003 by Gies and his collaborators. This is the simple expression, and it can also be simply evaluated numerically. For this, we use a finite ensemble of discrete random parts, which are distributed according to this Gaussian weight. And using such an ensemble, the path integral can be computed by simply summing over all loops in the ensemble. And the world line expectation that, yeah?
So, I mean, that is a way of getting a sum over all possible Dirichlet boundary conditions. Right?
Yes. Yes.
Now, presumably you could also derive that by fixing your values, which is the normal prescription for a boundary condition, and then summing over all possible values in the plates, give you the same result. And here is something of all trajectories with some value in one plate. And even on the other side, it might, you know, the same plate, you might have different Dirichlet boundary conditions. Your paths are either inside, don't intersect the boundaries, or they do stop on the boundary.
So we start with paths which don't care about the boundaries.
Right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But then your delta function picks out paths
yes.
that end
yes.
on one boundary and on the other boundary.
Yes.
And but might have different Dirichlet boundary conditions on the same plate. So I think you really exclude our paths that intersect the plate, go through it. Right?
I don't know if I understand you correctly. I mean, effectively, we sort paths which are contradicting the boundaries and.
Question I have is mm-hmm. that the paths you keep,
mm-hmm.
it seems from what I get, mm-hmm. the ones you throw away are the ones that intersect the boundary. Right? And the ones you keep are the ones that have it both, come in from designated close to the boundary.
Yes.
Which means that the paths you keep are Dirichlet boundary condition paths with no constraint on what the value of the field is on either plane.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so without introducing delta function, you could get the same sum by using standard Dirichlet boundary condition, summing over all paths that go from boundary to boundary.
Yes.
Or don't intersect the boundary. Those paths. And then integrating over all values of the boundary, the Dirichlet boundary condition. That should give the same result.
I think so, yes.
Is that the case?
I think so.
Because I was just thinking how you mm-hmm. can introduce, presumably you do the same with Dirichlet boundary condition. But I wouldn't do it this way.
Yeah, and we don't do it this way.
Second.
Up to now.
But do you have an instruction for non-boundary condition?
No. So this is probably a way to go then, yes.
It's also a way that is sort of ill-defined. Your way is sort of ill-defined for continuous paths. which I gather you don't do anyway numerically. You just use segments, some discretization for which this procedure is well defined.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The other procedure, of course, is well defined.
Mm-hmm.
They continue in it. So I'm a little, you know, what do I know? But you might run into problems in taking the continuum limit unless you have a definition that is, you know, guaranteed to be okay in the continuum limit. Your definition, how do I distinguish the path, which is epsilon close to the boundary, which is smaller than your resolution in the continuum limit?
I'm not quite sure whether I mean, so you are worried about having inhomogeneous biduality boundary condition. You want to prescribe the value on the surface, but he takes the limit lambda going to infinity.
What's
so
lambda
was the power multiplying the delta function. So his, he has the value
the
zero.
Function,
he has homogeneous derivative boundary condition. Lambda going to infinity, so he has homogeneous derivative boundary conditions. Values is a zero.
Sure, but. Delta function, if you're an infinite weight, no matter what it is, and it's localized on the surface, I don't understand why. You're saying for finite lambda, you don't have one.
If you have a delta function potential, the coefficient does make a difference.
In what dimension?
Not in one dimension,
like
there's a delta function
potential.
For given lambda,
you would find for the action Robin boundary condition, so the normal component would be proportional to 1 over lambda times phi, and if you take the limit lambda going to infinity, you have just pretty boundary condition. In order to impose inhomogeneous theory boundary conditions, you would have to add a term proportional to the normal derivative of the field phi.
But he's really only interested in the homogeneous condition that gets for the scalar.
Well, it depends on how nature chooses the boundary conditions on the scalar.
Okay, I mean, this is not what nature does. I mean, it's a simplified model, and we can study some aspects of Casimir and fluctuation and use forces in this within this simplified model. So, I mean, this is probably or this is something we have to think about when trying to extending this to more realistic scenarios. But
you know, the lambda equals to infinity limit does give you the physical boundary condition for one polarization of fields in the two dimensions. Right?
Yes.
That's it. Mm-hmm. It's not completely disconnected from nature. It's just you've only gotten one polarization. You don't have the Neumann polarization.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So the world line expectation value is just an arithmetic mean over the random walk ensemble. So just a few notes on the numerical implementation. We don't have to, I mean, we just generate so-called unit loops, which have center of mass at zero, and which are generated for t equal one and all. The rest is obtained by shifting and scaling the loops. The path ensemble can be easily divided into small sub ensembles, and which can then be processed independently on many computers, so we can speed up the computations by order of magnitudes. And for a given geometry, you can exploit the symmetries of the boundaries and specialize the algorithms and also reduce CPU time by this. And finally, there are often some integrals can be performed analytically. Okay, going back to Stephen Hawking's picture, this is now our version. So we have These are random walks taken from our computations. And so we essentially have to count the number of loops contradicting both boundaries. And this yields the Casimir interaction energy. And this works independently of the given geometry of the boundaries.
They're smooth on your scale.
Yes. I mean, smooth in what sense?
In the screen scale.
Yes.
If you would have a fractal, you could.
Yes, yes.
No scale much.
Okay, let me show you some results. First, omitting the integration over the center of masses, you obtain an energy density. And this is shown here for the sphere plate geometry. We have the sphere and the plate. This is in three dimension, so it actually looks more like this, like on the title picture. This density is concentrated right between sphere and plate. And now, to obtain the total interaction in energy we are interested in, we just integrate over. And the result is plotted here. Normalized by the lowest order proximity force approximation result, and plotted versus the distance between sphere and plate in units of the sphere's radius. So small distances, large distances, or large radius. And you will see that our numerical data in red with error bars nicely agrees with the two other analytic results plotted here. And now, by zooming into the small distance range, we can study with high precision the breakdown of the proximity force approximation. And I mean, this is for, of course, for this directly scalar field. However, I mean, it's a proof by counterexample that in this ranges here, you cannot rely on the proximity force approximation in general. Okay, and there are also now more recent analytic results for the lowest, for the linear order prefactor, for example, by Michael Bordak. And this is also a nice agreement with the numerical data. The same studies have been done for the cylinder above a plate. And again, this agrees very nice with the result of this group here, and with the more recent result of Michael Bordak for the linear order.
Sorry, yeah? Yes? Two lines for the
PSA? This is because the proximity force approximation is ill-defined, and one of the lines is this, in this case, cylinder, what we say cylinder-based, and the other one, the plate-based result. Okay, so it depends where you, how you orientate your parallel plates. So this shows that even this is not gives you really an error. I mean, you might think so. Okay, but beside these geometries with smooth curvature, we also studied geometries with involving sharp edges, and we had in mind nanomechanical systems where also edge effects and finite size effects will play an important role. So what we did was we studied configurations with an infinite plate and semi-infinite plates. So this is such a configuration, or two semi-infinite plates. And it turns out that the world line picture in this configurations gives you an intuitive understanding of the non-local effects important here. So for example, in the center, in the picture at the center, the energy density leaks out into the outer region of the plates, which can be traced back to loops mostly outside the plates, but nevertheless intersecting both of them. And this increases the Casimir force compared to the proximity force result.
Is this
energy density that you're plotting something that is experimentally or
physically? No, I mean, it's always only defined up to an up to a total derivative. So it's, I mean, it gives you, if you do the computations, I mean, you get a certain understanding, but it, I mean, it's not not really physically. So you can, I mean, you can guess if you think in terms of this density that the force actually is larger as if compared to what you obtain by simply taking the derivative, the proximity force, approximation.
I mean, I realize it might not be possible to measure, but why is it only defined up to a total derivative? Is it 0, 0?
I mean, it's...
You said it's only defined, or people only measure the total?
I mean, the Casimir effect is a, it's a non-local phenomenon, so it's, I mean, it's physically, it just makes no sense to give you a density at a certain point in space.
Energy
density.
Sure, this is correct. If you take into account gravity,
mm-hmm.
energy is the source of gravity. So in principle, we're looking at with amazing precision, which nobody can achieve anymore. But if you are able to draw the gravitational field generated by your device, you will tell that the gas is density, if it has physical meaning. I think it
does. There are a variety of energy benefits that one can write down, which differ by a total derivative, so the total energy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But there's a natural one in this case.
Well,
anyway, what is the one you use when you use the y dot squared plus y?
The
canonical one?
For what?
What is the one you use?
What one?
Definition of energy.
Your definition. What
did you do? I mean, and this definition. Okay. So this is just what we obtain. It's this definition. Okay. So it's just what we obtain by loops with a given center of mass. So I mean, this is one possible. And I mean, so it's.
How does this compare with the expectation value of the stress energy tensor?
I don't know.
Is it the same thing?
If you define it in the canonical.
Yes. It is the same. Perhaps, yes, I suppose it is.
I mean, we also, I mean, it's a bit, as I told you, here we use loops with given center of mass, and we take loops with a common starting and an end point, we will again get another energy density. So I
would it be possible to give an analogous representation to the stress energy tensor, to the time component, the canonical stress energy tensor?
Probably, yes. Probably.
Because in that case, that should be the meaningful quantity, no, which happens to gravity, hopefully. According to the standard.
Okay.
I have one more question.
Yeah?
So in all of the pictures that you have over here, there's only one landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be that? I want to know how to scale as far as numerics, and is there just essentially one number that you would be getting out of this?
Yes, and this is what we had in mind when we choose this configuration. So we wanted to. I mean, we can do any configuration in this model, but we wanted to learn a bit about. We restricted us to these configurations which are only characterized by one length scale. So I mean, you can tell up to a constant the Casimir force by dimensional analysis and. By the numerics, we obtain the prefactor of the corresponding terms. So actually, we computed one number. And
in the numerics, yeah. You have two sources of error.
Mm-hmm. Yes, two sources.
The error bar is statistical or also?
It's the statistical. And we choose the discretization of the parts high enough to so that it converges the result. So and the all the error bars in the curves are the statistical error.
Isn't there also a numerical integration over the center mass?
Yes.
Yes, so there's actually three sources of error.
There's
the discretization of the path, and then there's the discretization of the center mass integration.
Okay, you have all kinds of errors, but I mean, for example, the numerical integral.
Evaluate
a sine function on the computer and you have an error. So, I mean, these are orders of magnitude smaller than the statistical error. Okay. Okay, it's even worthwhile to revisit Casimir's simple parallel plate geometry. And the world line expression for the world line result for the interaction energy boils down to this expression. And as you can see, the only relevant quantity from the unit loops is their extension perpendicular to the plates. And this is the interaction energy for the Casimir effect in d dimensions. And this is just proportional to the dth momentum of this statistical quantity. And now, of course, we have an analytic result for this energy. In that comparison, we obtain this very compact analytic result for this momentas. And this will be used for later. I'll come to this. Okay, so we can study all kinds of geometries in this simple model, but we can also include temperature. This can be done straightforwardly by compactifying the Euclidean time. And now these whirl lines live on the topology of a cylinder and can be closed after winding around the cylinder several times. So for the computation, this merely means an additional sum in the path integral, summing over all possible winding numbers, positive and negative. So let's switch on temperature and first have a look on the parallel plate. The temperature-dependent Casimir force normalized by the zero temperature result plotted here versus the temperature in units of the distance. And you can see world line numeric result is a nice agreement with the analytic result. I took this from this nice paper, Feinberg and his collaborators. And what we observe is that for small temperatures, there's only very weak temperature dependence. And the reason for this is the gap at the lower end of the spectrum. You need a certain amount of thermal energy to excite the lowest mode. And below this energy, nothing happens. So this is exponentially suppressed. So now, immediately, the question comes up, what if there is no such gap? So let's zoom into this small temperature range and compare this result with the result for the perpendicular plates, where all kinds of modes fit into geometry. And indeed, while the parallel plate result hardly shows any temperature dependence, below 1% at least, in this range, we observe a rapid increase of this of the Casimir force for the perpendicular plates. And for example, at a distance at 1.5 microns at room temperature, you have a temperature correction of almost 6%. The thermal corrections are in particular important for such geometries without this gap, or open geometry, as we say. By the way, this dashed line is not a fit, but an analytic result obtained in the world line picture. Let me briefly summarize how you can do this. Again, this is what the world line expression boils down to for this case, and the only relevant information of the loops is in this function L, and this is essentially the extension of a loop at a given point zeta. And for small temperatures, it turns out that even the details of this functions are not function it's not relevant, but only the width of the support, this length. And as I've shown you, for the expectation value of this quantity, we have now an analytic expression. So this is, we have now to evaluate this for d equal 1. This is just 1 square root pi. And we can immediately write down the lowest order temperature correction for this geometry. OK, so let me conclude. So this world line method works in any geometry, so that we have studied curvature and edge effects, and we can easily include temperature and then study this interplay of temperature and geometry, and this is what we refer to as geothermal effects, and these effects are very important for open geometries. Now, in the future, we should study temperature effects in more interesting geometries and also include other boundaries. And besides, there are technically similar problems. For example, the Gross-Neveu model. Just a brief comment on this. For the Casimir effect, we had studied the dynamics of this classic potential under the influence of the fluctuating scalar field. Now, in the Gross-Neveu model, we want to study the dynamics of a classical potential, which corresponds to a fermion condensate under the influence of fermion fluctuations. And the interesting thing is that for certain temperatures and chemical potentials, this condensate forms such a spatial varying shape. Okay, but we'll not go into detail here, so let me thank you for your attention.
Is there a integral representation for the vector magnet?
No. So there is one, and maybe you can do me the favor and ask me this at the end of this program again. But
that's because of Neumann boundary.
Yes. Mm-hmm. This is.
For the full vector field, it's worse than Neumann. It's not Neumann. It's a mixture.
But it's a mixture.
Yeah.
Know how to do the general.
I think we should start with Neumann.
Actually, for the electromagnetic case, you would be able to use this, but what you would have to do is first decompose the electromagnetic case in terms of Dirichlet cases, and you could do that under electromagnetic, let's say perfect bound conductor conditions. You can break it down all in terms of Dirichlet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there should be a way of doing it in terms of Neumann.
Yes, then there is a way of breaking it down.
But to find a discrete approximation.
What about for 5 constant?
So how do you break the way you break it down? Let's say you have a rectangular box.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have your modes.
Yeah.
Okay. So all these modes are actually n equals 0 or n equals 1. So when n equals 0, some of them lie off. Right? Let's say you have products of sines or cosines, right? So you just basically the breaking down would be, let's say for 3 plus 1 dimensions, it would be 2 times the Dirichlet case in 3 dimensions plus Dirichlet 1, 2, Dirichlet 1, 3, Dirichlet 2, 3. In other words, x, y, x, z.
Suppose we just have 2 dimensions and we have some arrangement of conductors there. So we have 2 scalar polarizations. One where the electric field is this way, which is the Dirichlet case, and the other where the magnetic field is this way, which is the scalar field, and that's the Neumann case. So how do you represent the cases of the magnetic field or is out of the plane, the Neumann case, how do you represent that by Dirichlet boundaries?
Well, the Neumann case, you could break it down into Dirichlet, but let's say you have two dimensions, so you have sums over zeros, so you call, you just let one case be zero, add over one case, so it would basically break down into Dirichlet in two dimensions plus Dirichlet in one dimension and Dirichlet in the other dimension. So it's, let's say you're thinking 2 plus 1.
Sorry, yeah, and I'm following this.
So what happens if
you have a box in three dimensions?
Yeah.
So you would have
a scalar field.
You just draw
in 3 plus 1 dimensions with Dirichlet conditions on all boundaries.
He's asking where to get a cylinder.
Yeah,
it seems like the T can move with the magnetic field parallel.
Yeah, so I suppose I just have some arbitrary shape.
Yeah.
Okay. In two dimensions. Okay. And this is conductor.
Well, you really mean in three dimensions, but it's
really we actually don't really need the third dimension. We could have a two-dimensional system with, so you can think of it as three dimensions with Z invariant fields. And this is
oh, that's important, right?
Yeah, but that doesn't matter because if it's perfect conductors, actually you can, once you can solve the 2D problem, the 3D problem, you get the transformation, coordinate transformation. So okay, so we have this. So we have the Dirichlet enclosure is minimal height. So how do you represent the sum over all the, how do you represent the Norman case, the Norman field in this, first after calculate? So do you think you could take the Norman solution and map it to the Dirichlet problem somehow?
No, that's not what I was saying.
So what are you?
No,
saying?
What I was what saying. Would you, how would you no, I was saying something very specific. If you have a box.
No, boxes. You know, you're in arbitrary shapes, right?
I mean,
that's the whole point of these methods is for arbitrary. I mean, if you only have rectangular boxes, we can solve it other ways, right? So suppose you have an arbitrary shape. Is there?
Yeah.
How would you handle that?
I haven't looked at it.
Okay, so that.
You have really a 3D geometry like a sphere. You no longer have even splitting into Neumann and Dirichlet.
Yeah, or even if you have dielectrical. I mean, all of these things. Even just the 2D problems are interesting, right? So if you could just handle the 2D problems in Dirichlet plus Neumann, that already gives you a lot. And then, as you say, once you can handle Dirichlet and Neumann, then you can probably imagine that maybe you could get some mixture or get some more general boundary conditions.
It's not the problem to find a path into the left can be done for any degree of combination, which is surface dependent.
Uh-huh.
Right? The problem I see is just doing a discretization.
Maria also have a question which relates to this.
Well, then,
You used this delta function as an infinite coefficient to enforce the idea of boundary condition. But in the semantics work on the Casimir effect, he used a different trick. I mean, he has a boundary term of the form phi times no longer root of phi. And this gives then on one side Dirichlet boundary condition, on the other side Riemann boundary condition. Would that be useful? Or? Yeah, the coefficient is precisely one then of this term. So you don't have a lambda going to infinity. Would that just be useful for you?
I mean, maybe. But okay, so you have Neumann and Dirichlet boundaries on one side each.
Well, you can take an arbitrary boundary like this, and if you add such a term, then you have on one side Riemann boundary condition, on the other side you have Dirichlet boundary condition. Then, of course, if you compute, and you have two objects, and you can, of course, you compute differences, and then you can get both the case for Dirichlet and Riemann boundary condition.
Yes. So then. Maybe, yes.
Mm-hmm. So if I understand right, is the reason that Neumann is more difficult than Dirichlet is that Dirichlet is easier to write as a potential? Is that?
Yes.
But this delta function
yes.
is a potential.
Definitely.
And that's what makes the electromagnetic case harder, that it's hard to write a conductor.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's a potential. I don't know if you've looked at, just something that I've looked at in another context to solve the same problem is, imagine you put a scalar condensate, like a Higgs-like field.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a potential background. But that's like a superconductor where the field doesn't penetrate. Mm-hmm. And is that possible to do in this method, and would that have the effect of simulating a conductor because, you know, you get a skin net for the photon field?
I don't know. Yes.
Have you tried simulating the case of the box with different ratios for the sides?
No.
Isn't it true that in that case the sign of the energy, I don't remember if this result is for the electromagnetic field or also for the scalar field, with usually boundary conditions, but then you collect that the sign of the casimir energy for a box depends on the ratios among the sides.
I think
people say that, but it's
no,
not.
No, it's wrong. It's always not
good. People say that.
And the reason, so that was.
This is a wrong.
Yeah, it's a wrong result. The reason is that people were not taking.
It's been wrong.
Yeah, it's because people were not taking into account the exterior region. I would say. So what happens is that if you take the interior region only, it could be positive. But once you take the. And that was. The first person to work on that was Cavalcanti in 2004.
See, because I remember reading this statement, for example, in the review paper by Borgak,
so that's 2001?
It
was proven later, correct.
Because of contribution from the outside.
Exterior contribution.
By the way, perhaps this result is wrong. I don't know. I'm just asking. I do try to check.
No, we didn't do it.
Because it seems that your recipe gives a definite negative sign for the casimir. It looks like the way you define it, it looks that it is necessarily negative.
Well, it depends. No. I mean, it depends on the geometry. I mean, and often you can do dimensional analysis, and then you can already guess that the interaction energy has a certain sign, and with this you can say about the sign of the force. But
for you to simulate the box.
I mean, this. Probably interesting.
See which result you get. I mean, if the negative one or the positive one is depending on the ratios between the sides.
We've simulated the box and we get the same numerically. We get we reproduce the correct analytical result from the attractive force.
You mean for the parallel plates?
For like a box, a piston case.
Yes.
So the correct prediction is that it's a. It's an attractive force. So we were able to reproduce that numerically.
Yeah, that depends. I mean, if you're using purely a parallel plate result,
No.
Then it doesn't show up. But it shows up when you have when the plates become finite.
Everything. Okay. This is a full. That's another brute force numerical method for the finite case.
Maybe the two of you can debate as to the merits of the two numerical approaches. What are the?
I think we're going to have that for tomorrow's lunch. So. I wanted to ask about here. I realize this is a tricky question because there's a lot of error analysis involved. I mean, so I'm curious if you've analyzed what the scaling of the method is with. Length scales in the system. So typically you have several things. You have the number of Monte Carlo integrations, the points in the, and you have the number of points in the path, which presumably, as you increase the diameter of the system relative to the biggest diameter compared to the smallest diameter, you need to probably have finer and finer dispositions of the path. And then there's also the number of center of mass evaluations you need, which presumably also goes like the volume of the system. So, what is the overall scaling end up being when you include all those? And then presumably the number of Monte Carlo things also increases as you increase the number of disposition points and increase the size of the system. So, but what wasn't clear to me from reading the papers, how it ends up the product of all these things ends up scaling with the diameter, or say, I guess you need to non-dimensionalize. How does it scale with basically the biggest diameter in the system divided by the smallest? Feature size or something like that.
Well, I actually can't give you a precise answer. You have both these discretizations, finite ensemble and finite points on the paths.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in principle, um,
Another way of putting it is you should be able to predict, for example, the discretization over the separation of the bytes, for example, finite size effects, and see whether, as you increase the precision, you account for that. That's a sign you're in there. You really can trust those systematic errors.
Yes. Yes. Okay. I mean, we did not really go into detail there. I mean, you have then, as you said, the integration over the center of mass. If you increase the, you decrease the error of the discretization, then you also have to better integrate. And I mean, of course, this is also an additional computational effort.
All the systematic errors are much smaller than the systematic.
Yes.
That was based on something.
Yes, I mean,
I would just keep doubling the number of degrees of freedom until the thing converges for it, but I'm guessing you did something like that. You doubled the number of discretization points and the answer didn't change.
In principle, yes.
Mm-hmm. In principle, no, but presumably you must have actually done that, otherwise.
Yes, okay, we didn't double it, but okay, we watched that it's. It converts the result, yes. Mm-hmm.
With changes that are much smaller than this estimate.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So in the directing case,
I don't know.
Try.
Yeah, the problem is that you can do very many easy things so that as soon as it's in hard. So I mean.
No, but summing over paths is a way of doing path is not restricted for.
Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't know anybody's actually used this worldwide formulation for getting anything. Really, these vacuum effects are the easiest thing.
You showed that you get the same results for things that certain systems that we know of.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can you give us an example, let's say, where this method would be easier to use than the other method?
Well, actually, some of these results I showed you, I think our results were first, or partly. I mean, for example, this perpendicular, yeah, this finite plate stuff, for example, I don't think that there's any result for this. And I mean, I like this very much because we did the computations, and I think Thorsten said they have results too, and we both had the data and we compared it, and it fitted. It was.
So you're saying this exactly the same. Had not really been, had it been tried before, the one
version? I don't think so. No. I mean, it's. I think this is a nice example for this. Locality, because I mean, using proximity force approximation, also we had zero force, and so this is a nice example. But I don't think it's been done by other people.
You said there's a particularly strong temperature dependence effect in geometry. Is it because particular modes there are more accessible?
It's just that there are low energy modes in this configuration. Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's the same for a cylinder in front of a plane because that's.
Yes.
Yeah.
Same for these. For all of these, I mean, always if you have finite sized, for all experiments, you have finite sized objects, so you have all kinds of modes. And I mean, the effect is not small, sometimes more, sometimes less, but you should take all this in account if you want to reach a certain precision.
do two spheres?
We can do, but we didn't, no. I mean, there's some work going on, like in Heidelberg, for temperature dependence and certain geometries, so there will be some more results soon, I think.
I would like to make a remark, perhaps. I mean, the problem of random walks which interact with some boundaries is a problem that has been intensively studied in statistical physics. It goes back to Duchenne and was studied then at the beginning of the 80s by Eisenrichter, Kramer, and Binder. And you actually, in that case, you have different values of the lambda of the delta function, because the lambda then corresponds to an interaction energy a monomer has when it comes to the boundary. And there are also simulations, not usually, of course, people have just considered a single boundary and not, I mean, the additional interaction energy when you have two boundaries, but in principle, but there are also, for example, Monte Carlo results for polymers in the presence of walls are in the literature, and Eisenrichter even has written a book on polymer absorption where he also discusses the use of conformal invariance to polymers. So